Hi, folks. I'm so glad to be here. I really love lecturing to you guys. I love having you guys in the department. Last time I was here, we talked about a trauma issue. So I figured today we'd talk about a critical care issue. And I'm going to talk about one that, when I was a resident, always bored me to tears. You know, a ventilator talk, you just know there's going to be just a lot of stuff. It's going to go over your head. It's not going to be interesting. I'm going to try to change that, hopefully. You can tell me afterwards how I did. So we're going to talk about how to dominate the ventilator. All right, so Allison mentioned who I am, but to give you an idea of what my educational objectives are in emergency medicine, I want to take all the things that are done in the ICU that we know saves patients' lives and bring them down to the emergency department and bring them down in a form that is actually accessible to our environment, because we can't deal with, you know, starting 2 feet down there, and that's not really going to help. But if we do aggressive advanced ventilator management as well as they do upstairs, then we're going to do a lot of good for our patients. I still have no disclosures to make, no financial ties, and you should ask about that. If you don't have a lecturer tell you, you should find out, because it's really important to understand what conscious and unconscious biases they may have. So why is this topic important? Well, we injure people with the ventilators. We do, in the emergency department. They do the same thing upstairs if they're not doing a good job. And these injuries, they're iatrogenic, which is the worst kind of injury. And worse, they're insidious. So you're not going to know that your poor ventilator management is hurting your patient while they're downstairs. You won't know until 2 weeks down the line where they wind up with ARDS, or they wind up with ventilator-associated pneumonia that they might otherwise have avoided. So this is the kind of thing like placing a femoral line in a patient that looks good when you first do it, but later on they have a lot of bad sequelae from it. So good ventilator management might look the same in the ED as bad ventilator management, but later on in their course it's going to make a dramatic difference. This lecture is billed as advanced ventilatory management, and in some ways this is. This lecture is going to teach you basically the state of the art. If you follow the things I'm going to teach you here, no one could argue with your ventilator management. You'll never have a single intensivist or pulmonologist come down and say, what are you doing on this ventilator? They can't, because it's the only evidence-based strategy out there. But it's also very basic. It's also very simple. When I first came out of ICU fellowship, I gave a lecture to my residents on ventilator management. And, you know, it was all the advanced things I had learned, and I was so proud of the lecture, and it just was absolutely useless. It was 100% useless lecture, because it was things that half the ventilators don't even have. It's things people didn't really care about, and there was no basics there. So this is the most advanced ventilatory management you're going to hear, but it's also very simple to understand. There's only two strategies you need to know. This is it. There's only two strategies for every patient that comes to the emergency department. There's those patients who have lung injury or are predisposed to it, and then there are those patients who have an obstructive picture, like asthma or COPD. And that's it. So no matter who you ventilate, if they don't have asthma or COPD, then what are they? They're lung injury, or they're predisposed to lung injury just by you sticking the tube in them and putting them on a ventilator. If you treat everyone with these two strategies, you're never going to go wrong. So the asthmatics and COPDers on the right, and everyone else on the left.
So if you could just decide whether the patient has any obstructive signs, then you know which of these pathways they fit into. The first one we're going to talk about is the lung injury strategy. Now, you might say that makes no sense, because I have a patient, they're not asthmatic, they're not COPD, but they have no lung injury. They're fine. You know, we're intubating them because, you know, they have a stab wound to their belly. They're not a lung injury patient. And here's what I'll tell you. We're not anesthesiologists. We don't intubate patients because they're going for a knee scope and then we're going to take the tube out 2 hours later. Generally, when we intubate, they stay intubated for a while. And even if you show me a patient with perfect lungs, they're going to start developing lung injury just from being on the ventilator. Just from being on that vent, they're going to develop lung injury. So every single one of your patients either is injured already, they have a bad pneumonia, they have CHF, they have atelectasis, or they're going to be injured by being on that ventilator. Now, up until 3 weeks ago, I would say that based on all my knowledge of physiology and theoretical and animal studies. But luckily, in Lisbon, they had the European critical care meeting, and they presented an abstract there. They actually randomized patients to a lung protective strategy, which is what I'm going to teach you, and then just run-of-the-mill normal vent management. And the results were so drastic they had to discontinue the study as soon as it hit statistical significance, because all those patients placed on a non-lung protective strategy went on to develop acute lung injury. So now it's not just theoretical, but actual clinical data for this. And I'm not going to, you know, say this is absolute until the actual paper comes out. You never want to base anything on an abstract. But it's all pointing towards every single one of our patients should be managed as if they have lung injury or they're going to develop it. All right. So the lung injury strategy comes from a group named ARDSnet. Has anyone heard of it in the room? Okay, great, a few. ARDSnet is a consortium of folks. They grab federal money, and then they do huge multi-center trials to try to prove things related or tangential to ventilator management. And what they showed in a study, and the reference is in your handout. Do all you folks have handouts? All right, great. Which means there's going to be some, you know, a lot of numbers going by. You don't have to write them down. They're all in that handout. Nothing I'm going to tell you is not there. So the study is in there, and they showed a mortality benefit in this time in patients who already had lung injury using lung protective ventilation. So this is not just, you know, days on the ventilator. It's not ICU days. This is straight on mortality if you have a patient with sick lungs and you manage them lung protective strategies. So the first question you always ask is, what mode are you going to place the patient on? What mode are you guys using here? AC. And just in case there's any medical students in the room who aren't familiar, assist control or AC or volume control, simply you set a rate, you set a tidal volume, which is the amount of air in each breath, and that's what the patient gets. And if they were just unconscious, not doing anything, then that's all they'd get. And then if they decide they want a breath, they decide they want a little more air, then they initiate a breath, but the machine does all the work. It gives them a breath at the rate, at the tidal volume you set. So basically the patient is work-free in this mode. And it's the simplest mode. It's been there forever. It works fine. There's many debates we could have about other modes of ventilation. For our purposes, there's no reason to go to them. So I talked to your respiratory therapy department yesterday. I asked them what vents you guys have coming to you in the ED. And they said there's three of them. Two of them are from like the 1960s. This is the iVent. This is probably the one, if you had your druthers, this is the one you should request. It's a little more advanced. It's a newer version of ventilator. It has a few little things that make it a little easier for your patient to breathe. So if they could bring this one to you, that's great. We'll talk about this one, but the stuff I'm going to tell you is just as applicable to those prehistoric ventilators. All right. So we're going to pick volume control, AC mode on the vent. And then we have a whole host of dials we could spin. There's tons of things we could change, but there's only four that should matter to you, and these are them. VT is just a fancy way of saying tidal volume. IFR is inspiratory flow rate. RR is respiratory rate. And then I put FiO2, the oxygen, and PEEP on one dial, and I'll tell you why in a few minutes. But the first one we're going to deal with is tidal volume. Now, when some of the attendings in the room trained, they probably were taught, you know, you put them on 12 cc's per kg. If their training was a little later, 10 cc's per kg. That's the standard. That's what, when we talk about normal ventilator management, they're referring to. It's usually about 10 cc's per kg. I'm going to tell you that's too high. I hope if you leave this lecture and you believe what I said, you're going to use much lower tidal volumes on all of your patients. Let me explain why. All right. Now, a sick patient's lungs are not adult lungs. They're actually baby's lungs. And since this was first coined in Italy, they call them bambino lungs. Let me show you what I mean. All right, you take a patient, and they're not so sick, but they're getting towards that point. And here's what a CT of their lungs would look like. They have this junk on the bottom, and that junk could be consolidation. It could be atelectasis. It could be fluid from CHF or ARDS. And it gathers in a dependent fashion, and it basically takes these portions of the lungs out of the picture. So now you had a patient who had a lot of lung volume. It's starting to get reduced. And so now maybe up here, that's really good lung. That's perfectly workable. And this is in a transition zone between good and bad. Well, if you look at these lungs now, they're not the lungs of an adult anymore. They're the lungs of a child, right? This is, you basically halved your lung volume. And as things get worse, this entire portion of the lungs might be taken out of the picture. And this is all they got up here. That's a baby's lungs. They're, even though they're a 70-kilo adult, they have the lungs of, you know, a 10-kilo kid. And, you know, it's an exaggeration in some patients, but the point is that if you put the tidal volumes you put in on a normal patient into these injured lungs, the alveoli that are actually working see way, way too much air. And that's where you run into all the problems with mechanical ventilation. So baby lungs. So so as a result, you're going to set your tidal volumes as if they had only a small lung volume. And where you should be looking at is 6 to 8 cc's per kg. And if you just start at 8 on every one of your patients, you're probably going to be doing a really good job for them. So 6 to 8 cc's per kg. Now, that is predicated on predicted body weight. So if you show me a 500-pound patient, but they're 5'6", that patient's ideal body weight's around 65 kilos. At the end of the handout, there's formulas for figuring out that predicted body weight. Feel free to ignore them. We don't need to add complexity. You could look at someone and say, 70 kilos, 60 kilos, 80 kilos. You might be off by 5 kilos. It doesn't matter. The point is that you're not going to look at that 500-pound patient and treat them as 200 kilos, right? So even a little bit off is fine. You can just estimate it based on their height. So 6 to 8 cc's per kg based on their predicted body weight. And therefore, tidal volume starts equaling lung protection. Now, when I was first training, they told me, okay, you get an ABG, your CO2 is 58, go up on your respiratory rate, go up on your tidal volume. Don't do that anymore. Tidal volume is not for ventilation. The only purpose of tidal volume is for lung protection. And you're going to start out at a level that you think is going to be protective, and you're actually going to check it. I'll show you how to make sure it is. And that's the only time that dial should change, is if the lung is not protected enough. All right? So tidal volume only for protection, no longer to adjust your CO2. Doesn't equal ventilation. All right. The next dial you're going to spin is inspiratory flow rate. If you had to forget one thing, if you had to totally ignore one thing I'm saying, this is the one. It's not that important. It's not going to affect mortality, but it's going to make your patients comfortable. And here's the concept. On AC volume, it doesn't give you a variable amount of air throughout the breath. It gives you one set amount, what set rate during the breath. Now, take a deep breath here. All of you, please, deep breath, deep breath. It's going to help you concentrate anyway, get some air to the brain. All right, when you took that breath, at the very beginning of the breath, there was a lot of airflow. And then as it, towards the end, it petered out. That's normal physiologic breathing. You breathe a lot at the beginning and then just a little bit at the end. The ventilator's not doing that. It's giving you a constant rate throughout. Now, if you had to think, what would be more comfortable, to get a lot of air at the beginning and maybe a little too much at the end, or not enough at the beginning, which would you say? The first one, indeed. Patients aren't too upset if they get the air they want at the beginning and maybe a little too much at the end. They're miserable when they don't get as much as they want at the beginning. They start sucking on the endotracheal tube like it's a straw, but of course the ventilator won't give them any extra. And they get really agitated, and that's when you start pulling out your VEC and, you know, trying to paralyze these patients, when all they're trying to tell you is they're really not happy with your settings. Inspiratory flow rate is how you fix that. So 60 to 80 liters per minute, if you set them at 60 and you're giving a 500 cc breath, it means they're getting the breath in a half a second. That's usually enough air for most. A really young, buff guy with a really heavy, strong respiratory musculature, they might even need higher. If you see them sucking at the tube, you just knock it up. You can't make it this really a wrong setting. So you can play with it, see what makes the patient comfortable. Those iVents I had showed you, that you guys have access to, actually has adaptive flow. It'll actually let them breathe physiologically, give them as much flow as they want. It's one of the reasons I think you should request that as opposed to some of the prehistoric vents they might give you. But if you're on one of the older ones, you have to set this 60 to 80. Feel free to ignore. Nothing bad will happen. So all inspiratory flow rate, it's also called peak flow, is important for is patient comfort. Respiratory rate. Let's do a little math here. In a normal tidal volume breathing patient who's not intubated, you need about 60 cc's per kg per minute to maintain your CO2. As soon as you add the endotracheal tube and the ventilator, it goes up to 120 cc's per kg. All right. So if you had a 70 kilo patient, what kind of minute volume would you need? Won't force you to do the math. It comes out to 8,400 cc's a minute. We'll round that up to 9,000. All right. So 9,000 cc's per minute just to maintain CO2 on the ventilator. If you put them on 500 cc tidal volume, which is a reasonable thing, it's between 7 and 8 cc's, how many breaths a minute would they need? 18. That's exactly right. And that should be your starting point for most of these patients. The problem becomes when you put them on 10, which is seemingly the standard in my residency. Way too little. They're going to be hypercapnic. They're going to be upset by it. So 18 breaths per minute, 16 to 18 is a very good starting place, and then you're going to adjust based on your CO2. Wow, now this is, one sec, Jess, I see you. As a result of this, now things become very clean, because the only way you're going to adjust for CO2 changes is with the respiratory rate dial. And therefore, you don't have to worry, which one do I turn, tidal volume or respiratory rate? It's easy. Respiratory rate equals ventilation. And you could turn it as low as you need to or as high as you need to. You can put them in breaths on the 30 level. You can put them in breaths on the 40 level. It's okay, as long as they're not the obstructive patient. So you take them as high as you need to get your CO2 where you want. Jesse, you had a question?
Probably obvious, I'm just not seeing it. The reason why the ventilated patients need higher minute ventilated volume.
The circuit itself and the tube steal some of that tidal volume away. Yes?
Do you generally start people on higher rates than 16, 18 if they're septic?
Anytime you have an acidosis which is being compensated for by the patients prior to intubation respiratory rate, obviously you don't want them to lose that. And the sepsis case is a great example, DKA cases, and your aspirin toxicity. All of these need to have much higher respiratory rates with the prediction that the patient's acidosis status would worsen if not. And I think that's what your question is alluding to, right? Yeah. So absolutely, start as high as you predict. If you have end-tidal CO2, it's not a precise measure of their PaCO2, but what I like to do you guys have end-tidal CO2? Okay, so if you see a number before you intubate them, try to shoot for at least that same number afterwards. It might not be exact, but it'll get you in the ballpark. Oh, okay, so I'm hearing some... When I say, do you have end-tidal CO2, I mean that's going to give you a number, not just an easy cap on your tube. Do you have a quantitative end-tidal CO2? Okay.
No.
Okay. All right. So since we had tidal volume now for lung protection, inspiratory flow rate for comfort, respiratory rate for ventilation, you get to the last dial here. And I put two things on one dial because in an ideal world, that's how it would be. You would not be able to change your FiO2 without changing your PEEP. And they actually make a couple of ventilators that are doing this now. But for the most part, they're separate dials, but I want you to start thinking about them as one. All right. Here's how I play it. I start at 100%. Wait 5 minutes, and I get my ABG. After that, I drop them right down to 40%. I don't titrate. I don't mess around. Right down to 40%. All right. And then the way you're going to manage this is by using a PEEP scale. And this PEEP scale, as you get good, you can not have to pull it out. You just basically know what, you know, is the general idea here. But what it does is if the patient's not oxygenating sufficiently, and that not sufficiently means less than 90%, the studies looked at 88 to 95% as the range you want them in. I use 90. So if my patient's below 90%, I'm going to go up. And the way I go up is by stepwise choosing PEEPs and FiO2 in one of the vertical boxes. So for instance, if I started here at 40%, I'd have my patient at 5 a PEEP. If their saturation's 82%, just move up one box. And that means I don't touch my FiO2, but I knock my PEEP up to 8. They're still not above 90%, move up one box, 50% on the FiO2, keep the PEEP at 8. And you just keep moving back and forth until you get them above 90%. And by the same token, you don't go above 95%. You don't need to waste all that extra stress to get to 100. 100 is not a good place to be. You lose all your ability to use your oxygen saturation as an actual monitor of their oxygenation, because 100% could represent a PaO2 of 75, or it could represent the PaO2 of 400. There's no way of knowing. I see your question. 95% gives you much more information, and you don't have to add extra to the patient that might injure them. So 90% is a good place to shoot for, and you just keep taking them up. Now, you look at this and you say I'm crazy anywhere past this point, I imagine, because most people do. And you're going to be like, I'm never going to have a patient on 24 PEEP. We're going to kill him. And it's just not true. And I'm going to tell you a few reasons why it's just not true. First of all, PEEP does not cause barotrauma. You just have to accept that for a second, and then I'll prove it to you in a minute. It's not the PEEP that causes all the lung injury. This was considered the low PEEP scale in the ARDS-NET studies. They actually studied in a second arm of the study numerous patients, this versus the high PEEP, which would be starting at 10 and going up to the 30s. There was no difference in complications. There was no difference in mortality, so they said you might as well use the low PEEP scale. But there was difference in secondary markers like ICU days, like ventilator days. So this is considered the lowest safe way to go in your lung injury patients. Now, in the ED, generally you do not need to get to this point. These patients aren't sick like they're going to be 5 days in where they need to be at this point. So most of your patients around here, around the 70% 14 mark, they're doing great. Every so often, you might have to creep up even higher. But I promise you, I'm going to show you why this is safe. There was a question?
Yeah. Why do you need an ABG if you're doing this based on SATs?
You don't need an ABG to do any of your ventilator management. 100% FiO2 ABG gives an enormous amount of information to the intensive care folks. If you can't get to it, if you forget, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's not going to affect this. You're not going to know what your CO2 is, but if you really needed your CO2, you could send an ABG at any point, or you could send a VBG. But having that one ABG on 100% when the patient first gets intubated gives me a lot of information later on about how bad those patients' lungs were when they got there.
In an ideal world, this is what your alveoli do between inspiration and expiration. Inspiration, they're about yay big, not collapsed. You put some air in during inspiration to get bigger, but not too big, and that's a safe ventilatory strategy. If you're adding too much tidal volume, a not lung protective level tidal volume, anything above this line, and I'll show you what that line is, they get over-distended. That's where lungs pop. That's where you get barotrauma, pneumothoraces. All the evils of the ventilator are when you're over-inflating. But there's another evil that's not spoken about as much, and that's if you let your alveoli collapse during expiration. And that cyclical collapsing and opening is the worst thing you could ever do for alveoli. That's the way to damage them, even better than this. So the concept is, the reason we had that PEEP scale on the previous slide is, if the patient's dropping below 90% SAT on at least 30 or 40% FiO2, then their problem is shunt. And shunt does not respond to more oxygen. And the reason they're shunting is these alveoli are collapsing. They're either collapsing, they're filling with fluid, they're filling with junk and pus. You can't let that happen. That's how they're going to get injured. So what the PEEP scale forces you to do is to keep the PEEP level during expiration high enough that there's not this collapse. That's what's built into that PEEP scale. And if you do that, then hopefully during expiration, the alveoli will stay a little bit open, and then it's a lot easier for you to, A, put more air in the next time, and it's safer for the alveoli as well. So that's the concept of maintaining PEEP along with your FiO2. You might get a few minutes of the patient improving by just leaving their PEEP where it is and knocking their FiO2 up to 100%. They're going to be where they were a half hour later, but even worse as more and more of those alveoli collapse. It's not a long-lasting strategy for making things better. So 100% FiO2 is not the solution. Once they're about 40%, more FiO2 really does not help very much, and it's just masking the problem. All right, so when you talk about PEEP, all sorts of good things. Improves VQ mismatch, decreases shunt, decreases the atelectotrauma, which is that collapsing and opening of the alveoli. It improves spontaneous breathing, and you can figure this out for yourself. If you've ever blown up a balloon at a birthday party, when is it really hard? It's really hard before you get any air in there, right? Your face gets all red, and then you get a little bit of air in there, and now all of a sudden it's really easy to blow up the balloon. Same thing with the alveoli when you're trying to take a spontaneous breath. If they have a lot of closed alveoli, it's really hard for the patient to breathe on their own. If you have the alveoli already partially open, it doesn't take them much effort at all. Now, there is some bad that comes with PEEP. It decreases venous return, increased intrathoracic pressure, less blood to the heart. You could fix that. You give them some fluids. They might need pressors a little earlier. The trade-off is usually worth it. Obviously, if you have a patient whose blood pressure is 40 over 10 and they're about to go to the OR to get their stab wound of their abdomen operated on, maybe PEEP not the best idea. All right. The myths, though, are that it causes pneumothorax or the patient's head will explode. At Mount Sinai, I have a very good group of medical intensivists I work with and deal with from the ED, except for one issue, and I just can't understand it. They totally bought into the ARTHNET study. They totally understand that it's the only evidence-based ventilatory strategy out there, and yet they will not take their patients beyond a PEEP of 12. They'll do everything else. They use the low tidal volumes, and they just will not take their patients beyond the PEEP of 12. And it's my belief that their patients are doing poorly as a result of it. I don't understand where their bias comes from. I'm going to show you how you know that these high PEEP levels are safe. But FiO2 in combination with PEEP is changed to affect oxygenation. So now you have a very clear distinction between all the things you want to accomplish in your patient and which dial to turn. Plateau pressure is how you know they're safe on the ventilatory mode. When you first put air in, this is a pressure versus time graph. A very sharp rise in pressure, and then this upsloping, and you eventually peak out here. That peak is your peak pressure. That's what the ventilator is measuring. That's what's alarming. It means nothing. It's a useless measure. All right? If you have a bad asthmatic, their peak pressure is going to be ridiculously high, even though their alveoli might be fine, because peak pressure only measures the resistance of your upper airway, your endotracheal tube, your bronchi, but not the alveoli. And the bronchi, they don't get damaged. They're strong structures. You could do whatever you want to them, they'll be fine. It's the alveoli that get damaged. Peak pressure does not represent that. Eventually, if you just hold where you are on the ventilator, you'll get this plateau. That plateau pressure is what the alveoli see. And if that plateau pressure is at a safe level, then your alveoli are fine, regardless of what PEEP settings you have them on. It means your tidal volume settings are good. So the plateau pressure is all that matters. And 30 is the magic number. Right? If you have your plateau pressure below 30, then they're doing great on the vent. How do you measure it? Well, I can't, on these pictures, show you the actual button, but one of these buttons should say inspiratory hold. And you just hold it down at the end of a ventilation. And there's probably a number that appears down here that actually tells you, but even if it did it, this doesn't project well, but this is just the scale of pressure with the patient's breath. And as they breathe in, it goes up, that says 50, that says 40. And as they breathe out, it drops back down to whatever their PEEP setting's at. If you hold that inspiratory hold button, this will level off at some number. If that number is below 30, you're golden. Your plateau pressure is below 30, your patient's lungs are safe. Question?
I thought one of the issues with the high PEEP was the difficulty of maintaining the plateau pressure below 30. If you're PEEPing 24, how do you do it?
Let's talk about that. So let's just say peak pressure means nothing. Okay, so now you get your plateau pressure. You had them on a high PEEP of 24, and now their plateau pressure, because of that high PEEP, is 34. So what do you do?
Just drop your tidal volume.
And that's why we said you start at 8. If the plateau pressure is high, you go to 7. If the plateau pressure is still above 30, you go to 6. And if you need to, you go to 5, 4. You increase your respiratory rate. And maybe you're like, oh my God, my respiratory rate's now 30, I don't want to go any higher. That's fine too. And these patients might become hypercapnic, and you accept that. We call it permissive hypercapnia, and it's a lot better to accept that hypercapnia than to injure the alveoli. So whatever way you need to get that plateau pressure below 30, you do it. Now, there's ICU studies when these patients get really bad, you could actually scrub out their CO2 from their blood and allow you to maintain oxygenation, not care about ventilation, and then you could leave them on really low tidal volumes. We're not going to be doing that in ED. You're not going to need to. Like I said, very few of your patients are going to make it up to a PEEP at 24 unless something else is going on, like they have no cardiac output. That's not going to be fixed by the ventilator. You have to fix that by fixing the heart. So that's an excellent question. You're not going to see that problem very much, but if you did, you have the way to fix it. You just knock your tidal volume down low enough so that the plateau pressure goes below 30. Which brings up the issue of sedation, because if you have these patients on these high rates, you know, maybe they're a little hypercapnic because you're accepting that to protect their lungs, they're going to get a little agitated. And what's your standard sedation package for your ventilator patients here?
First set,
okay. Anything else?
Propofol.
Okay, propofol. Both fantastic agents. Both not going to help what's really going on with your patient. And I'll just stand on my soapbox for a second now and tell you, because this is one of the most important issues to me in ED management of ventilated patients. Let's say we took Jesse here. Jesse's a fairly normal guy from the limited interaction I've had with him. There might be stuff I don't know. But the point is that he's sitting here comfortably happy, and maybe we decide, you know, as a little experiment, we're going to intubate him, we're going to sedate him, we'll see how he does, all right? And we put Jesse on the ventilator, and 5 minutes later, he's a stark, raving lunatic. And I'm sure you've seen this, right? Normal patients, you're conversing with them, but you're like, your CHF has gotten really bad, you failed the BiPAP, we're going to intubate you, and they say, yes, please, and they're talking. Normal people, and then you put them on the ventilator, all of a sudden they're crazy, they're trying to pull out their tubes, you're like, oh my God, this patient's insane. What happened? Does the ventilator induce psychosis? No, it doesn't. Okay, so the reason Jesse's so upset now is one of two possibilities. Either he's in a lot of pain, because it hurts to have an endotracheal tube stuck in the back of your throat. It's like, you know, you're sticking a toothbrush back there, but leaving it there, you know, not just taking your dinner out of the equation. So as a result, he's not a happy man. He's in a lot of pain. Or we didn't put his respiratory rate high enough, and he's hypercapnic. And there is no sensation the body hates more than hypercapnia. It's basically the sensation of drowning. And your body will do anything it can to fix that hypercapnia. So for one of those two reasons, Jesse's now a lunatic. The sedatives don't solve either of those problems. All they do is tell the brain, no, really, it's okay, even though you feel like you're dying. And it takes a whole lot of sedatives to convince the brain that their body's not dying when it knows it is. And it doesn't fix the pain. The pain is still feeding back to the spinal column, still upregulating all sorts of bad neurotransmitters. Their hypercapnia is still making a whole lot of things happen in that brain that the sedatives, since they're a higher level blockage, are not fixing. What your patients need when they're on the ventilator is opioids, because opioids blunt pain, and opioids blunt the body's perception of hypercapnia, right? That's why your heroin abusers stop breathing. For both of those reasons, fentanyl or morphine boluses are the absolute necessity for managing a ventilated patient. You put those on first, and you see how they do. And you might very well get in a situation where once the fentanyl drip started, or you give 6 milligrams of morphine, all of a sudden, Jesse's now a happy guy, but he's still conversant with you. I mean, obviously he's not speaking, but he understands what you're saying. You could actually consent him for procedures. He's a fully awake, happy patient on the ventilator. This is what you want. Now, you don't need to remember your ED or ICU course. That's not fun, right? There's a whole lot of bad things happen. So we add on a sedative to that opioid. They'll get amnesia. They'll be able to sleep. It's a good thing. So absolutely use Versed. Absolutely use propofol. But use them after you've taken care of the pain, after you've taken care of the hypercapnia perceptions. And they're all synergistic, so you're not going to have to use as much. The sedatives have problems associated with them. The patients spend longer on the ventilator. They accumulate. The opioids don't. And pain relief is one of the few things we do in emergency medicine that we could take home and say we really did good by our patients. So please, add opioids to whatever sedative regimen you're using. All right. So we're about...
Do you advise with propofol, if somebody's on propofol?
Yeah.
Do you still give more opioid or...
Well, propofol has no pain effects whatsoever that have actually been demonstrated. And my,
you should still...
Absolutely. And the thing about propofol is it's such a potent agent that you will blunt their insanity, but it's just going to make you feel better. The patient's still inside roiling. They're still miserable, but they're just not going to be able to show it to you. So... any of our sedatives, with the exception of ketamine. Ketamine is it's not really a sedative, it's actually dissociative, but it has fantastic pain effects. No one's done a good adult study of long-term infusions of ketamine for a sedation package. And that's just low-hanging fruit if you guys are looking for something. But that is a single agent that might have potential. All right. So these discordant images actually, according to adult learning theory, will reset your brain, allow you to take a little bit more information in, because at this point, by rights, you can't listen to anything else I'm saying and retain it. But we'll give it a shot. All right. We're on the obstruction strategy now. That's your bad asthmatic, your bad COPDer, anyone who has airway obstruction. If you had to pick one goal on these patients, if you had to put it into one sentence, what would that goal be? Well, I hear oxygenating. It's a good answer. It's not quite the answer I'm looking for. Decreased resistance. That's great. That's alluding to the answer I would say.
Keep the VLI open and ventilate.
Okay. All good answers, all getting towards what I want. My goal is to allow them time to exhale. These patients are just waiting to exhale. That's what they're doing. All right? They need time to exhale. That's your big goal in these obstructive patients, because you know the pathophysiology, right? They could get air in usually. They can't get it out. And now you put them on a ventilator, all sorts of bad things are going to happen if you don't get that air out, like bilateral pneumothoraces, et cetera. So your goal is to give them time to exhale. So what motor are we going to use? AC. Easy. You don't have to worry. Just use what you've been using, assist control. Tidal volume, also easy. 8 cc's per kg. Just start them up there. Usually you won't have to change it. Inspiratory flow rate. Well, if we want to have as much time as possible to exhale, then we want to have as little time as possible spent inhaling. You can knock up this rate, and you can take it up to 80, 100, and 120. But again, if you have to forget one thing I'm saying, this is the one, because in the grand scheme of things, the amount of additional time this generates for exhalation is minimal. So if you forget this dial entirely, it's not going to make a big deal. But if you wanted to, just theoretically, give them more time to exhale, you can make your inspiration shorter. You do that by raising up the flow rate. FiO2 and PEEP are relatively easy. You put them on whatever FiO2 you need to keep them oxygenating greater than 90%. But for most of these patients, unless there's something else going on,
that's not going to take very much FiO2 at all because they don't have oxygenation issues. Their issues are all ventilatory. So put them on 40%. If they need more, knock them wherever you want, and just to keep their sats greater than 90. But usually 40 is more than enough. So 40 to 100, wherever you need. But the PEEP, on the other hand, is easy because you're going to put them on zero. Now, I could debate, and I have debated for hours, as to whether PEEP should be used in obstructive patients, and there are theoretical reasons why yes, why no. It's not worth the complexity. Nothing bad will happen with a PEEP of zero. Really bad things can happen with PEEP in these patients, so why not make it easy for yourself? If you're sedating these patients, they're not going to have a problem with zero PEEP, so I would say just put the PEEP at zero, leave it there, no worries. All right? And this is for endotracheal ventilation. Non-invasive ventilation is a whole other talk, and for those patients, a little expiratory pressure might be helpful. For these patients, not necessary. The respiratory rate is the key. This is the absolute key setting for your obstructive patients. You start low, you start at 10, and you're going to go down if necessary. And we already said, if you put them at 8 cc's per kg in 10 breaths a minute, what's that going to happen to their CO2? It's going to be a little too high. That's okay. This is, again, that permissive hypercapnia again. They will accept CO2s higher than you'll imagine without any problems. If their pH is staying above 7.0, 7.1, you don't even bat an eyelash at a CO2 of 80 or 90. It's not a problem. They'll do fine. The studies are out there for that. If their pH is getting lower, I'd still say don't increase their respiratory rate. Don't increase their tidal volume. And they usually do okay. And then we talk about things like putting them on a base drip, but that's usually the ICU level management. You don't need to usually worry about that. In the ED, they get better, and they don't have these problems, as long as you keep doing some very important stuff. What I see is the emergency physicians I work with at my center are so aggressive, so properly aggressive about getting continuous nebulizers, of albuterol, Atrovent, magnesium, steroids, all on board right away, really aggressively treating these patients. And then they get intubated, and now the patient looks great, right? They're sedated, they're on the vent, everything's fine. And what happens to those nebulizers? They're gone. And you haven't fixed anything by putting these patients on the vent. In fact, you in some ways have made things worse. And yet you're not treating them anymore. So you have to continue the nebulizers or the intermittent albuterol puffers throughout their ventilatory course in the ED, or else they get worse instead of better, because the vent didn't fix anything. The vent never makes these patients better. So you adjust your I to E, 1 to 4, 1 to 5, which is just saying the same thing. We're giving them time to exhale. If your vents measure the I to E, this is great. If it doesn't, it's not a big deal. If you put them on the proper settings, you'll be generating these inspiratory to expiratory ratios. All right, we talked about permissive hypercapnia and its importance. And this is all predicated on avoiding air trapping and auto-PEEP. And the concept here is if they need prolonged time to exhale but you don't give it to them, then the next breath is going to go on top of what's already there. They might have air that can't get out because the bronchioles have closed down. All this contributes to PEEP, to pressure in their chest. If it gets too high, things start popping. All right. This is, again, that iVent, that good ventilator you guys can get if you ask. And it has a graph up front, and this is pressure over here. This one, it doesn't project well, but I'm going to show you a better picture in a second, is flow. This just looks at air coming in and air coming out of your patient. This is what it looks like graphically. It's that same graph right here. This is what it looks like. You take a normal patient, right, one of you or me, you put some air in during inspiration, stays there for a little while, and then it starts coming out. And what happens is, and follow this dotted line, you breathe out a lot at the beginning, less, 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 less. And eventually you get to the point where you have no more air to breathe out. And you can see there's a space between that point and the next breath. That's normal. On an asthmatic, what could happen is you put air in, it starts coming out, it's coming out, it's coming out, it's coming out. And look, there's still air waiting to come out. You know, they probably extend out to here if we let them to fully exhale. But instead, we put another breath in before they fully let the air out. If you keep doing that for a few cycles, they're going to have really bad lung injuries. So as a result, what you want to do is you just want to look at your flow graph and make sure the expiratory flow hits the zero line before your next breath. If it doesn't, what do? Decrease respiratory rate. It's just that easy. All right? And you'll decrease the respiratory rate enough so that you see your flow line hit zero before the next breath. And that's
right here, you see inspiratory, expiratory, plenty of zero space there. But as long as there's even a little bit of zero space, you're in good shape.
Let's say you're using one of the older ventilators. It doesn't have the graphics. It doesn't have a flow graph.
Well, we could go right back to that plateau pressure I told you about. Because if they have auto PEEP in their chest that's going to keep their plateau below 30, we said their alveoli are safe. They're not going to get the pneumothorax. They're not going to get the problems. So as long as the plateau is below 30, you're golden again. So again, you just hit the inspiratory hold button at the end of one of their inspirations. It'll give you a number. If it doesn't give you the number, you can just look at this graph on the side and see what that plateau stops at. If it's less than 30, you're in good shape. If it's greater than 30, decrease your respiratory rate, add more bronchodilators, and your patient should get better. All right, so who's a fourth year in the room besides Jesse? Any fourth years? Okay. Oh, really? Oh, great. All right, so you, my friend, I'm going to give you a situation. If you don't get it, it's no problem.
You got a guy, you intubated him, you did perfect ventilatory settings for their bad, bad asthma, and you went to another bedside because there was a trauma. All right, you left that patient, their blood pressure was 120 over 80, their oxygen saturation 100%. The nurse calls you back to the bedside because now the saturation is 32%, the blood pressure is 60 over 20, the patient's sweating and looks like death. What is your absolute first action? There's tons of things you can do. What's the first thing you do? That is fantastic. And did everyone hear that?
Disconnect the patient from the ventilator. Don't mess around with chest tubes. Don't whip out the ultrasound machine looking for the pneumothorax. Don't do anything. Don't look at the ventilator, seeing if the settings were changed. You just come over to your asthmatic patient, and you just rip the vent tubing off the endotracheal tube. Now, if they had tons of auto PEEP that caused them to get hypotensive, then you fix the problem instantaneously. And all you'll hear out of that endotracheal tube is a continuous sigh of exhalation, and all of a sudden their vital signs are perfect. We've seen asystolic arrests, especially during transport when the respiratory therapist is bagging a little more aggressively than you had them set. Asystolic arrests, you disconnect them from that BVM, and all of a sudden their vitals are perfect again. So that should be your first action. Now, if you disconnect and nothing happens, well, now you have a whole host of things you have to look into, like that pneumothorax, like changes in ventilatory settings, like something else bad going on. First action, as you've said, disconnect them from the ventilator. All right, so we're running out of time for this lecture. Let's quickly review. Only two strategies, lung injury and obstruction. If you get those, you can ventilate any one of your patients. Mode is always AC. Only four dials you got to worry about. Tidal volume is lung protection. Inspiratory flow rate, patient comfort. Respiratory rate is how you generate ventilatory changes. And FiO2 and PEEP in conjunction are how you affect oxygenation. Plateau pressure is your friend. If it's less than 30, these patients' lungs are going to be safe. If it's greater than 30, they're at risk. All right, that's all I have for this one. I'd love to take any questions.
I mentioned this at the beginning of the lecture. I use this protective strategy on every single patient I intubate who's not an obstructive patient, because either they're already in a lung injury situation or just being on the ventilator is enough to cause acute lung injury, and they will eventually develop it if left on high tidal volume settings.
Is there any study to support that starting in ER is just changing the length of the stay or mortality data?
The study in the ED is waiting to be done. The study I had mentioned that was in the European International Critical Care Conference was in the ICU taking patients with healthy lungs and randomizing them to this lung protective strategy versus a 10 cc per kg strategy. And so many of those patients on the 10 cc per kg strategy went on to develop acute lung injury, they had to stop the study. Any other questions? Should we take a short break before the next one?
Great.